So ladies and gentlemen, we're just announcing the start of the next session, which is going to be on food and the environment. So if you'd like to take your chairs, please. Just one thing, Nick Hell's great film on the Battle for Lewisham is also running now. If you'd like to go down to the audio and TV room, if that's something you'd like to watch. Great film, of course. But now we're on food and environment. So the speaker's just joining us on the stage now. Okay, welcome everybody to Food and Environment. So if you'd like to take your chairs, please, that'd be great. If you want to sit a bit further forward, that's also very good. So we're going to try and start on time in a few moments, and we'll have time for questions after the speakers. So my name's Greg Williams. I'm the chair and timekeeper for this session. I'm just a local resident, and I'd like to welcome now, please, to the platform. Our five speakers, we're very lucky in this one. Let's run through them. First of all, we have Rosie Boycott, who is, of course, the Mayor's advisor on food and chairs the London Food Board. Also a very well-known journalist, editor of national newspapers, I think for one time a farmer, and I certainly read copies of Spare Rib, which I believe you founded in the 70s. Is that right? I remember having to read that in the 80s. Rosie, who will begin. Then we have Sophie Tranchell, who is the CEO of Divine Chocolates. You will have seen her wonderful chocolates, both at the back there, but in many, many supermarkets. The great thing about Divine Chocolates, tell me if I'm wrong, is that they work with a cooperative in West Africa, in Ghana. Is that right, Sophie? And the cooperative itself owns 45% of the business? But you've also been a campaigner on other issues, including apartheid, I think. That's right. Okay, great. Then we have, from Deptford Folk, the Green Spaces movement locally, Trina Linsky. Hi, Trina. So that's Folkestone Gardens and Deptford Park and so on. Lots of really energetic stuff going there locally, really important. And next, I think that's Olaf. Olaf, of course, is a lifelong animal rights advocate.
That's right. With animal equality.
With animal equality. I think that's something that touches many of us, and very pleased to have you with us, Olaf. And finally, but not least, James Skinner from the New Economics Foundation, who has a lot of experience in the economic and agricultural development work overseas, especially in Africa, engaged in renewable energy and sustainable transport and farming initiatives through your own companies and foundations, and you're a trustee of the New Economics Foundation. So your problem, I'm afraid, speakers, is that we've got about 8 minutes each, 8 minutes, maybe 10, and then we'll be taking questions. So I'd like to hand a microphone first to Rosie. Is it the...
Hello?
Okay. Cool. Thank you, Rosie.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here. I'm going to take it as read that the rest of my fellow panellists, and it's very nice to be here with everyone, are going to agree with me that things aren't working very well, to put it mildly, in our food system. I have a job, a curious job. I run something called the London Food Board, which gives me a seat at the table within the GLA. And from that particular place, you look out at a city like ours, like London, and we serve up, this is my estimate, but I'm pretty sure I'm roughly right, we serve up something between 30 million and 33 million meals a day, which is completely and utterly daunting when you think about it. And you then think about it with a political hat on, and you go, well, this food system isn't working. What the heck would I ever do about this? This is so complicated, so difficult. And then on another hand, you would say, well, hang on a minute. We do feed 33 million meals a day, give or take a few. So surely this is a food system that is working. And, of course, on one level, it is working. But we have to say, first of all, who's it working for? And at what cost to everybody else is the current way that it's working? Because... make no mistake about it, and I suspect that this subject has come up quite a lot already today. I mean, food, as we see it at the moment, probably with the exception of my friend Sophie and colleague Sophie, food is a really major part of the capitalist economy. It's absolutely huge. And you can rail and rile against capitalism in lots of different ways, but when you look at it from a food optic, it's an absolute effing disaster. Because if you apply the model which says what we want is to grow, is to sell more product made from cheaper ingredients, which, okay, you could apply to a Primark t-shirt, and don't get me wrong, Primark t-shirts are also killing the planet and very bad for a lot of people. But when you work that into food, it really, really is destructive on an incredible number of levels, because it means that, going right back to the source, you don't pay the grower, you don't pay the farmer. How do you make money on something that we all should eat, say a very simple head of broccoli or a cabbage or a cauliflower? You can't do much with it. You can take it out of the ground and you can bring it to the supermarket and you'll make X. But if you do something else with it on the way and you add cheese sauce or you add whatever, you're suddenly making X plus Y. And so all over the world, what we have basically now is processed food. And processed food is causing a catastrophe on a level that is actually unprecedented. The WHO, about a year or so ago, said that the food system is now the biggest, what you call NCD, non-communicable disease known to man, that we've ever had, ever. Because disease, up to now, you know, you think of disease and you think, actually, this is malaria, or, you know, this is something that is infection, this is the plague. But actually, this is our plague. And some of the statistics of what's happening to people as a result of our food system are really appalling. I mean, something I heard not that long ago was that they cut off more limbs in Vietnam last year due to diabetes than they ever did at the height of the Vietnam War. That China now has half of the population in a pre-diabetic state. And they've got 300 million registered diabetics in that country. And in the guy who used to run BP, Lord Brown, he wrote the most terrible book, which I had to unfortunately read, because one of the things I do is I work a lot at the Hay Festival. I had to interview him one year, and he wrote this extraordinary little paragraph about China and the health. And he said that the Scandinavian company that has developed the diabetes drug had shown incredible initiative, because they had seen the problem in China, and so they had set up clinics. And now they had been rewarded by the fact that they had 70% of the market in diabetic drugs. And you look at it and you think, for God's sake, I mean, think of the money you're getting. Anyway, that's a sort of diversion, but let's bring this all a lot closer to home. Food is an issue of inequality, and I know that various politicians over the years have had their noses smacked for trying to say that, but it's true. There is a really big difference that is widening now in our society. I mean, in London, we have one of the biggest populations of overweight and obese kids that there is, certainly in Britain and certainly in Europe right now. The 50%, if you look at Tesco's Kantar surveys about what people eat, roughly 50% of the population have sort of got the message, getting the message about food. And the obesity rates in kids are coming down. And in the poorer half of the population, the obesity rates are going up. None of this is helped by the victimization culture that goes on around food, which says, actually, it's your choice. Now, I would say, and people I work with would say, it's not people's choice. You take advertising on a very simple level. Advertising is such a curious industry. It's the only one where, in this instance, the advertisers want you to believe that their advertising doesn't work. But if you take the overall advertising budget of 100%, 1.2% only is spent on healthy food. I mean, how do you stand up against that? We have 8,500 chicken and chip shops in this town. There is no ruling. There is no law that can touch them to say you can't halve your price at 3:30 when the school kids come out. But just do it. They're capitalists too. They're trying to make money. If you're poor, though, and you live in tough housing, you have a million bad and tricky decisions you have to make every day, the law of the chicken and chip shop, which at least is guaranteed to make you feel good for a bit, was pretty strong and completely understandable. It is a complete scandal in this country that for someone who is on benefits or in low-paid work, for all the months of the holidays, there's no extra money to feed your kids. There's no extra money. One of the projects we do that is, it's awful to have to do it, but it is proving that we can do it, is literally feeding kids in the holidays, because they know now the extent to which a child who hasn't been properly nourished comes back to school, and they're behind. And we also know that a kid who doesn't get a decent breakfast, or indeed goes to school on a can of Coke and a packet of crisps, doesn't do as well. So again, all these issues become inequality. So where's it gone wrong and how do you change it? There's no ministry. My friend Tim Lang, who is some of you may have heard of, he's a professor of food. He's an amazing man. He worked out at some point that food, in some little major or minor bit, lived across pretty much every ministry. It's in 17 departments. Nobody takes responsibility. There is no joined up thinking between DEFRA, which is food and farming, and health, for instance. And yet, without a doubt, the health burden is caused by the fact that we're eating the wrong thing, and we're eating the wrong thing from being very young. And the impact of diabetes and NCDs around diet on the national health is beginning to cripple it and will cripple it more. All avoidable, and yet we don't do it. Theresa May, when she came in, they were sitting on an obesity strategy that was infinitely more powerful than she allowed to be published. There are moves that maybe they will get through, but even simple things like a 9 o'clock watershed on junk food, starting to really lower salt commodity, sugar amounts reformulation, which is what is being worked on at the moment. It's voluntary. Oh, I'm up to time. Okay. Right, let me pass over to Sophie, who I know will... I'm sorry I've overrun, but you could probably get the drift.
So I'm on a presentation now.
Wherever you like, Sophie.
I've got a presentation. So
marvellous. Have you loaded somebody, it?
Yes. Yes, he's going to come slides. And put it up. Yes, I've got slides, sorry. While you're loading the slide, I'm going to say I'm really pleased to be at this Festival of Ideas because I'm here at all because 20 years ago, a group of farmers in Ghana and some people in an NGO that was working with them had the idea of setting up a chocolate company that the farmers would significantly own so that they would put themselves higher up the value chain. And so if those people hadn't had that idea 20 years ago, you wouldn't be enjoying the chocolate and I wouldn't be here talking to you about it. So ideas really are what makes the future.
Yep. No, they should reach that. So you're good to go.
Good. Mightyo. So, have we got a bit light? Sorry. So, I'm pushed to speak in 8 minutes. I usually get a lot longer, so I'll probably speak ridiculously fast. So in case you haven't seen it, that's what divine chocolate looks like. There's some at the back if you want to taste it. And we're here today also because people like you have gone into shops and asked for it. You've shared it with your friends and families. You've got it stocked in your local canteens. And we still need you to do that because we don't have the money that the big companies have. Following the previous session, the chocolate industry is more consolidated than even the ones they were talking about. So the chocolate industry in the UK is worth £4.6 billion. And it's 80% dominated, owned by three corporations. When I started, that was four corporations. That's Kraft, who now own Cadbury's and Green and Black's. It's Nestle and it's Mars, own 80% of a £4.6 billion industry. So what's special... Oh, we still haven't got it up. Okay. So Divine Chocolate is unique, and we're an independent company, and we're the only mainstream chocolate company in the world that is... All of our products are fair trade certified, and we're 44% owned by a cooperative of cocoa farmers in Ghana. There's more than 85,000 of them organised in 1,257 villages, and they're democratic and they're really into empowering women. So when they have their annual general meeting, they send two people from each village to ensure that a woman gets to participate. And this is the lovely picture of two farmers who came over to speak for themselves last year. So we also work with 90,000 farmers worldwide because not only do we source the cocoa in a fair trade way, we also source all the other ingredients that can be fair trade in a fair trade way. So that's things like sugar, which comes from Malawi, things like vanilla, which comes from Uganda and Madagascar, mangoes, coconuts, nuts. And so we're getting all of those things on a fair trade basis as well. So Divine creates four income streams for cocoa farmers. We pay a guaranteed fair trade price, and the way that fair trade works in cocoa is that there's a world market in cocoa, and when the world market falls below $2,000 a tonne, which it is at the moment, we pay $2,000 a tonne. If it goes above that, we pay the world market price. We then pay $200 a tonne extra on top of that price. And the important thing about that is that the farmers get to decide how that money is spent. And then, because we are 100% committed to this, we invest 2% of our turnover in working with the farmers, and that's 2% of our top line, so not of our gross margin, and that means that's more than doubling the impact of fair trade. And then the fourth income stream that the farmers get is that because they own 44% of the company, they have two seats on the board, they have a say in how the company is run, but they also get 44% of any distributed profits. And we've distributed a profit since 2007 for every year apart from 2010, which was when we took the hit from the financial crisis. That the 2% that we invest in producer support and development has been invested in things like women's literacy programs, because illiteracy among cocoa farmers is very high, but it's even higher among women. And it's one of the barriers to participation, because if you want to lead an organization, democratic organization, if you can't read and write, that puts you at a severe disadvantage. It in fact puts you at a disadvantage in your life in a way that you can't imagine. Imagine taking medicine if you couldn't read the packet. Imagine trying to get on a bus home if you can't read the front of the bus. We've also invested in radio programmes because that's a really good way for people to talk to each other and learn about their organisation in a very non-literate environment. And so that the picture in the middle is of people listening to the radio station together and talking about the subjects that have arisen. And then the third thing that recently we've been investing in is recognising that even smallholder farmers, that's family farmers, do employ people. And how do they employ people, and what is the terms of that employment? So we've been helping them improve that relationship, which is beneficial both for the people who are working for them and for themselves. So the question I was asked to address was the idea of the difference between fair trade and big corporations. So increasingly you're starting to see big corporations have their own schemes. So you've seen over the last 10 years Cadbury's come into fair trade, so they put the fair trade mark on a Cadbury's Dairy Milk, and they've now taken the mark off, and they're now going to say that they're still doing as many good things, but you've got to trust them. And you've now also seen Sainsbury's do something similar. So Sainsbury's has got a tea called has had fair trade tea with a fair trade mark on it, and it now has fairly traded tea. And this is even better for farmers than fair trade. And so I think one of the reasons people asked me to come and speak was, what did I think about that? So we all depend on smallholder farmers for 70% of the world's food. So we need to get this right, otherwise there won't be enough food for us to all eat. So when corporates have corporate sustainability programs, what you'll find is that it serves their purpose. I think this has become the theme of the day in a way. And so their focus is that they want to continue to have more supply of cocoa. And that doesn't necessarily benefit farmers. So higher productivity isn't the only answer, because when if farmers have had to spend lots of money on inputs and on labour, then they don't actually necessarily get higher income for higher yield. And the way that corporates work can create dependency. And then the conversation that happened earlier about profit maximisation comes really strongly into this, because actually, even though in British company law it's not legally enshrined that you have to profit maximise, you do have to report for your financial performance on a quarterly basis. It makes it very difficult not to profit maximise. And so that actually you're having to trust a corporation to do the right thing for the right reason, when what it's reporting on is profit maximisation. So it's very difficult for them to keep that agenda going when times get difficult. I also think that it's very important that there is third-party verification. I think I've come from a background of having been an anti-apartheid activist. I spent my youth telling people what not to buy, and I spent my adulthood telling people what to buy. And I think it's very difficult for us to tell what corporations are doing. One of the better corporations, I would have said, was Unilever, and they've made some very big claims about halving their carbon footprint while doubling their turnover. And I don't know how we'll ever know that they did it. How can we tell? We've just got to trust them. So I think that we can help smallholder farmers all over the world continue to grow our food if they have a stake in their own future, if they're sustainably paid, if they have the skills to adapt and diversify, if there is independent verification, so people like us who care about how people are being paid can know that people are being paid properly for the products we're buying, that there is physical traceability, that you actually know that the product you're buying is coming from the farmers you think it's coming from, and that the farmers actually have an opportunity to add value. I think we can make cocoa farming worthwhile and create a future which is good for cocoa farmers. I wanted to finish, so I'm flicking through because I'm running out of time, is I think that actually this is all in our hands. Certainly Divine is here today. When I started, Fairtrade had an awareness in Britain, so that's 20 years ago, of 7%. It now has an awareness in Britain of 86%. We've done that with very little money, but with people like you. And so we need people like you to take your values to work with you. And my mum's here today. I think taking your values to work with you is if you can't tell your mum about it, you shouldn't be doing it. I think we all, I think setting up businesses is quite foreign to us in Britain, but I think it's something we should consider because we can do it in a better way. We can set up cooperatives, we can set up things that have stakeholders properly enclosed in it. And I do think that this isn't a radical proposition because I think people like the Quakers who set up businesses like Cadbury's, like Clark's Shoes, like Quaker's Oats, like to an extent John Lewis, like the cooperative. These are ideas that have been here for hundreds of years. And I think then I hope that you will take that the fact that you're here today and enjoying the chocolate that we've made is that actually when we started, the idea of a chocolate company that was significantly owned by cocoa farmers was deeply unfeasible. Even the people who invested in it wrote it off on their books. And so I do think that if you can imagine something, you can make it happen. And I hope that we will inspire you to set up your own things and make the world the way you'd like it to be. Thank you.
So, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Olaf here, who's going to talk to us. You've also got a presentation,
yeah.
Hopefully, not on the other stick.
No. So, just while I'm getting this set up, please raise your hand if you've ever been into a factory farm. Thank you. That's exactly what I expected. Very, very few of you. What I'm going to be providing everybody with at the end of this when we go into the breakout room is an opportunity to go into a factory farm using virtual reality. So I hope some of you will take me up on that. So animals are sentient beings. What this means is that animals can feel pain, they can feel joy, and they can suffer. This has been enshrined in EU law since 1997. And actually, just last week, it was voted to exclude this clause in the Brexit bill. So we're really in a very dangerous place where sentience and the protections that we give our animals are going to be in jeopardy. What I'm going to be talking about are the impacts of animal agriculture on the environment, the impact on human health, and then I'll also look at what the future of animal agriculture may look like. So factory farming in the UK has grown massively over the last 50 years or so. Around 2 billion animals are farmed in the UK every year, and 70% of these are factory farmed. So it's a vast percentage of all our animals. And you can see a map there. Pretty much every county in the UK has factory farms. So if we look at a breakdown here of the animals that are farmed in the UK, if we look at chickens, for example, we've got 900 million chickens that are farmed in the UK, of which 96% of them are factory farmed. That's intensive farms, cramped conditions, cages that they can barely move around in. Think of an A4 sheet of paper. That's the kind of space these chickens have. What you're looking at here is an example of an M&S dairy farm at the top there, where they put the calves after within 48 hours of being brought into this world, put them into those hutches. At the bottom on the right, you see an intensive dairy farm. And on the other side, you see what we're more familiar with, which you'd probably see in an organic farm. But those concrete slatted floors are far from those beautiful fields. In 2006, the UN produced a very important report, which was called the Livestock's Long Shadow. This report showed that 18% of all greenhouse gases are caused by animal agriculture. This was contested later on, and they revisited the way they calculated it, so it's still between 14.5% and 18%. Transportation, so planes, trains, buses, all forms of transport, only account for 13% of greenhouse gases. That means that you can make far more of an impact by changing your diet to avoid animal products than you could ever hope to do by walking everywhere and never getting on a plane again. What is the industry hiding from you? So a lot of people don't know that soya, in particular GM crops, are now in all of our animal products. Dairy cows are being fed GM soya, beef, cattle, so forth. A lot of people don't know that it's GM, unless certified organic. There are a lot of cruel farming practices. We always talk about our high welfare standards in the UK. We still castrate young piglets without anaesthetic. We tail dock. We de-beak hens. All of these things, very painful, and we do them on a systematic basis. 93% of all soy that we consume in the EU is for animal feed. Think about that. That's a massive statistic. And the marketing of animals tends to sort of brush out the connection to the animal. So we've got McDonald's, for example, who have an internal policy never to show the animal, keep people desensitized. Water pollution. This is a huge issue. So if we're looking at intensive farming, there are a lot of fertilizers used. That nitrate then gets into the water supply and causes dead zones in our oceans. Deforestation. This is another huge issue that we see predominantly in South America. This is an example of a soy plantation. So you're burning down the forests, releasing hundreds of years of CO2, and causing untold damage to biodiversity and local habitats. Another very interesting thing is the amount of soy that is actually in animal products. So if you look at this chicken breast, 109 grams of the 100 grams of chicken breast are from soya. So the amount of soy that we're feeding our animals is coming back through these systems. Soil. We had a warning just a few weeks ago from Michael Gove that we've only got 30 to 40 years left of fertility in our soil due to our intensive animal agriculture and our machinery that we're using. If that is not enough to shake us and scare us into changing and making more sustainable systems, I don't know what is. If we look at health, so we know from the World Health Organization that there is a direct correlation between eating processed meat and causing cancer. We also know from a British Medical Journal study this year of over 530,000 people that spans 16 years that there's a direct correlation to eating animal products and 8 diseases, including cancer, diabetes, heart disease, respiratory disease, and so forth, and even Alzheimer's. Live transport is another issue with this industry. So these are some beautiful bulls that came from Ireland, covered in their own feces, put in boats for 7 days or so, temperatures of 30 degrees. We do not treat the animals like we would treat them in the EU, but we're shipping them for days to all these other countries. Untold suffering. Why are we doing this? This is a dairy farm that I have been into. This is in Somerset. I found this absolutely shocking. Before I went in, I didn't think dairy was that bad. This is an example of hobbles. These are these chains you can see. Now, these chains are put on these beautiful cows because of the huge amount of milk that they're carrying, but also the pelvic damage that a lot of them experience while giving birth. So the farmers are putting these on to prevent them from losing those profit margins, because they'd have to put the cow down if her legs split and her pelvis broke. So what does the future of animal agriculture look like? So we had the COP23, the big climate change conference just last week in Bonn. Why was animal agriculture not on the agenda? How is this happening? Why is there not an exit strategy from these industrial animal agriculture systems? Well, we should have one just like we do for oil, coal, and gas. So I have 3 policy suggestions which you can see here. which I would love to put to government. The first is to factor in climate change into the cost of animal products. A study by Oxford University found that it would mean around 20% for dairy, 40% for beef. If we also put VAT on animal products, this would make a huge impact. And if we look at the CAP, the $2 billion in direct payments, if we focus that on plant agriculture, this would also have an incredible impact. Three simple steps everybody in this room can take today. Cut back on milk, meat, eggs, and dairy. Try going meat-free one day a week. Try Veganuary. Go vegan for January. There's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of support. You'll save energy, wildlife, protect nature, and reduce untold suffering and death for millions of animals. Many, many alternatives exist now. You can eat out in Pizza Express, have a vegan pizza. You can switch out all of these wonderful products and make a real difference. Interested in learning more? Some wonderful documentaries. Most of these are available on Netflix. I'm sure a lot of you are fascinated at the moment by David Attenborough's Blue Planet. Reconnect with the animals. Reconnect with our connection to them. A lot of us in the UK love our pets. Why can't we extend that to farmed animals as well? One last thought. My view is that in this glass of milk, you have more suffering than in this piece of steak. And if you would like to understand why I think that, come and speak to me in the following session. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Olaf, for that great insight. So,
don't worry, I'm just ignore me.
Now, Trina is going to take over. Trina Linsky from Deptford Folk. Thank you very much, Trina.
Good afternoon, everyone. So the organisation I represent is Deptford Folk. It's a parks group in North Deptford. It's a very hyper-local response to what's going on in the area in which I live in. And the project I'm going to talk to you about, we do a range of projects, but the one I'm going to talk to you today is one that we are doing. It's called Evelyn 200. And Evelyn 200 is about planting trees. And I'm going to tell you a bit about why we're going to plant these trees and how we're going to do it. Let me tell you a little bit about Deptford Folk. It's a constituted park user group that's interested in enhancing parks, just like most groups. But we've also included that we are interested in the routes that people take to those parks and the routes that people take between green spaces in the area. We received funding last year to do a survey of park users. So we did lots of quantitative data about what people wanted from their parks, who was using the parks, and all of those things that you need in order to establish what your priorities are. But we also received this anecdotal evidence and qualitative data about what people were really concerned about in the area. Air quality was a major one, routes between parks and trees. So what we did was we went and found evidence as to why these problems were coming up and whether what people were thinking about the area in which they live in were true. And let me tell you a bit more about where Deptford Park and Folkestone Gardens are. It's up in the very, very northern bit of Lewisham, right by the river, the bit that used to be part of Greenwich, and many people are nearer to Southwark or nearer to Greenwich Borough. And it's named after a 17th century resident called John Evelyn, who's very famous for his diaries. And those diaries they were published 200 years ago next year. And John Evelyn is most famous for those diaries, but he also wrote about trees and air pollution and biodiversity and urban planning and healthy eating. And these are all problems of our age and issues that we're all concerned with. John Evelyn wrote about air in London. The people of London are haunted in their daily business by a dreadful smoke that causes many health problems. Whatever is pleasant and refreshing should be planted, fragrant shrubs, trees, and flowers. He wrote that in 1661, but he could have been writing it today. So it's very apt that we have this former resident to link our project to. The ward itself it's one of the poorest wards in the borough, very high levels of child poverty, and also when we did our research, we found that it has the lowest number of trees and the worst air quality in Lewisham. We have one of our schools is on the Mayor of London's 50 schools for the air quality audits, which are undergoing at the moment and will report next springtime sometime. And we also know that across Lewisham, adults and others are not using parks and green spaces to exercise or use them for health reasons. And we know that green spaces have a positive impact on physical and mental health. Goldsmiths University have just completed a project, a citizen sense monitoring project, and Deptford folk took part in this. We had these little fellas in our balconies, in our gardens, outside cafes, measuring the particulates in the air. These little pollution monitors were artistically modelled around what a particle looks like, and these are minute particles. And they published their initial findings this week, and if you want to learn more about that project, it is all online, but they found that the results were at 6 times the safety limit for pollution levels, and that was in the papers last week. So that's what we're living, that's what I breathe every day, and my children. And on a positive note, this year is the 800th anniversary of the Charter of the Forest, which is a 1217 Magna Carta for trees, if you like. And what the Charter of the Forest wanted to do was make sure that the common people had access to trees and forests. And at that time, it was about coppicing and fuel and grazing. But the Woodland Trust relaunched it this year, and what they've made it is a charter for trees, woods and people, that everybody should have access to woods and trees and green spaces. And Deptford Folk is a charter branch for that. So we have all these particulates. We have particulates, we have John Evelyn, we have diaries and Fumi Fujium and the silver that he wrote about trees and with the Charter for Trees. And we as a parks group are thinking, how do we deal with all of this and is it beyond our control? And what we decided to do was plant trees. We want to celebrate John Evelyn, we want to highlight the levels of pollution, we want to enhance the parks, and we want to engage people with their built environment. And we decided the best way to do that was to plant 200 trees in our ward. Now, it's not as easy as planting 200 small trees. The trees you have to plant in the density of urban space where in North Deptford, which has most people wouldn't have their own outside space, we're planting 5-metre trees. They cost anywhere between £200 and £500 a go. So the first group that we're working with in order to deliver this project is the council. Lewisham Council is the landowner. It's very important. A lot of people embark on these projects and don't get permission from the landowner. And the landowner is the council, and we are the council because it's our land. So we're working in partnership with them, and they're very supportive of this project. The second group we're working with is Street Trees for Living, who have a big flag there. If you're looking for inspirational people who came up with a madcap idea and decided to make it happen, Street Trees for Living are fantastic, and they have helped us a lot on this project. They're going to help us plant 10 trees and more across the ward. This is one of the streets in Evelyn. There are no trees left. We're going to work with Street Trees for Living to deliver some of those trees. The model that Street Trees for Living use is that residents pay for trees, but with the socioeconomic deprivation in the area, what we're going to try and do is match funding and reduce the individual cost of trees or pair people up with funded trees with those who can afford it. And we do that by having very tactful work within our community. The first 10 trees we plant, for example, 3 of them are GLA funded, 2 are residents, and 5 are with a corporate funder, and that's how we're going to do that. And hopefully more of our trees at the end of this project will look a little bit more like this. And the third way we're going to deliver trees in the area is with organisations that already do this. So we've already started a consultation with the Orchard Project we did earlier this month, where we are going to replace all the missing trees in a grove of trees in Deptford Park with fruiting trees. And we will be planting that in January. We're going to have a planting and then a wassail. And what's important about this project is the physical trees will be planted in the Evelyn Ward, but anyone can get involved and plant trees and join us for any of the events. It's a positive response to what are huge problems of our age. This is a map of what the empty tree pits in part of Evelyn. And in order to make sure that we can work and get those tree pits filled is we're working within our local community who were suggesting places for trees. They're coming and planting trees with us, designing schemes and thinking of ways that they can source funding to do this project. So far we're about halfway there on funding. We have got developers to commit to buying a tree for every year group and all the primary schools in the borough, which is great. That'll mean just over 1,500 children being part of planting a tree where they live. We have the Orchard Project obviously investing as well. But we did plant tree number one on the 6th of November. The 6th of November was the 800th anniversary of the trees, the Charter of the Forest. And when we were messing about on the catalogue online, because none of us are tree experts, we put in Evelyn to see if there was a tree, and there is. And luckily, it's also very pollution resistant and great for our soil. So that's the first tree we plant, and that was funded by the council. The next planting will be the orchard, and then we will continue from there. And hopefully, actually definitely, by the end of next year, we will have 200 trees planted, which is a drop in the ocean. Someone asked me, that seems like a lot of trees, but when I spoke to Street Trees for Living and others, they said, you could plant 1,000. So look out for us in 2020, when Evelyn is 400 years old, and maybe we'll do an Evelyn 400 if we're not half dead from doing this. Thank you.
Trina, thank you very much. I'm sure John Evelyn himself will be proud of this. Great for that. So thank you all, especially to everyone on the panel here who have been keeping so wonderfully to time. James from the New Economics Foundation is now up. Do you have a presentation, James? Or?
No, just me.
Just you?
Afraid so. Sorry about that. I should say that I'm not a trustee at the moment of the New Economics Foundation. I was a trustee for 20 years. I'm now a trustee emeritus, not pretending to be something I'm not. I'm very grateful to Olaf for his presentation because it's laid the foundations to say how disgusting and abominable the whole business of current modern farming is, and we have to change it. It's not. He only described half of it, which is the factory farming side of it. The rest of it is the devastation that is being caused all over the world by growing food for animals that are kept in these revolting conditions. And that is the most dangerous thing of all, because we have only identified about one third of the species that exist on this planet, so we are told by ecologists. And we don't even know about the other two thirds. And we don't have any idea of what the effects are, relationships between these species. And in the last 50 years, we have destroyed 50% of the biodiversity in the world. And that is terrifying. It means that we are sitting on a branch where we're sawing hard to saw it off and destroy everything that exists. This is the most fundamental question. The whole question of food, which we need three times a day. We can't survive for more than a few weeks without it. We have to keep feeding more and more people because we've done nothing about population. And we're doing it in such a way that we're actually destroying all our resources. So we have to do something about it. And the reason why I've set up a small trust called Conservation Farming Trust, which is a very tiny little effort to do something in this direction. I'm trying to promote the idea of agri-villages. And the idea of agri-villages is to enable people to get involved with producing food. At the moment, it's thought to be very clever because we have maybe one person cultivating 1,000 acres. And everybody said, oh, that's wonderful, that's modern science for you. It is not modern science. It is grossly inefficient, and it's very destructive. What we need to have is small-scale farmers, like Sophie was saying, 70% of the world's food is produced by small farmers. We need to have the right kind of symbiotic combinations of food produced from plants, animals and fish, and naturally produced so that they are each helping the other. We've got to stop trying to destroy nature and work with nature to try and understand how nature works, not just when something happens which is inconvenient for us, just to kill it with poison, pouring poison all over, to think that we can go on having huge machines that are going to compact the soil and use fossil fuels. We have to get back to much more human labor-intensive farming, which is going to be combining these different parts, much more imaginative. so that you can produce a much larger amount of good food, good healthy food, from the same area of land. And then you have room for housing so that people can actually live on the land and be close to the land. The idea of the agri-villages is that it's not a new idea, for goodness sake. As long as humans have been growing food, they collect in little villages where they can help each other in farming. And what we are proposing now is to target councils and landowners and explain to them that if we set aside, say, 200 or 300 acres of farms, or buy farms as they come on the market, and then use about 10% of that land to build really well-planned, very high-density, good house, quality housing. We built a tele-village in Wales, Crickhowell, which is an example of how you can have a high-density housing scheme, which is really attractive, keeping cars out, having very well-insulated houses, well-built, out of local materials, have an energy-positive community. And people can have access, who live in it, can have access to the land so that they are able to cooperate together and go in for cooperative marketing. And by that, they can get direct to the consumer instead of having to go through the whole corporate structure of the supermarkets. And you get a good price for healthy, fresh food. And this is for the benefit of the market and for the people who grow. Because at the moment, there are a large number of young people, particularly, and there's going to be more people coming onto the market as robotization increases. They're looking for, first of all, housing, with that, jobs, and a satisfactory way of living and making a decent living. And this can be done if you have a community which has got access to land, which has got broadband, teleworking, so that you can do all kinds of different businesses, diversity of occupations, you have a diversity of housing, different age groups, different levels of income, and a mixed community, good communications with the nearest market town, if it's in the country, or if it's on the edge of the town, peri-urban farming, good communications so that you're not cut off and you can get to your market. This is a logical, rational way of organising jobs and housing and access to land and good, healthy food. And so it's a simple idea, and it's something that appeals to investors because they have an opportunity to invest in land and housing, which are the two best long-term investments you can have. And we are hoping to use this attractive form of investment to put together a group, we're working with the RSPB on this, who want to do the same thing, to be able to get hold of land as it comes on the market and stop it from just going further into the traditional, what has become conventional farming is actually modern chemical energy intensive farming. We must stop that. We've got to turn into a farming system, a food production system of healthy food coming from healthy soil. And that is what Lady Balfour and the organic movement started. So that's my time's up.
I think we really would like to thank the whole panel for their contribution. So we can take some questions now, a few questions, and then of course this debate will continue with those of you from the audience who want to continue in the breakout room afterwards as the next session runs on in here. So if there are any questions to the panel, either individuals, got one over here. Anyone else has anything to ask? And one here. The lady in the multicolored shirt. Any other questions? That's two. One from John. Okay, so we've got four questions. Lady over here, this gentleman over there, gentleman here, and it's Richard, isn't it? Yeah, so if you'd like to go first.
Yes, that's fine. Thank you. Thank you for everyone's contribution today on the panel. My question is going to be very simple. I mean, we talk about very idealistic models of farming. We understand that the food system as it is broken. But essentially, who will be the farmers of tomorrow if we're thinking of that very human-driven farming system where people sometimes forget that actually, unless you're farming from tree crops, it's extremely labor-intensive to actually cultivate. So even if you've got a commune of 30 families, I would expect that you can probably feed yourself to some extent, but you wouldn't be growing at a surplus to then sell on to the nearby town. I mean, this is something that, I mean, tell me how you do it and I'll sign up tomorrow. That's it for now.
So who will be the farmers of tomorrow? Who would like to take this on? Rosie, perhaps?
I love the idea of the agri-villages, but I also take your point of view. I mean, there is a lot happening, I think, in farming now. I don't know if you know about Groundswell and the no-till movement, which is incredibly interesting, and they had an amazing soil conference last year. I mean, it is, you know, this is literally about don't turn your soil over, and you can capture huge amounts of carbon, you improve the humus, you cut down the use, you cut down water by 25%, you almost start to eliminate needs for chemicals as well. And so there is a lot happening, and the very interesting thing that I saw the other day, do you understand what Roundup Ready is? Okay, so Roundup Ready, which was only put in the market by Monsanto about 12 years ago, it has already been completely defeated by three varieties of superweed, which grow to about 6 feet tall. So this is happening very quickly that people, and I know Michael Gove has taken up, for instance, the whole of the idea of no-till, because, of course, you're not doing that kind of thing. So there are a few positive things that are going on, although, I mean, I'm kind of with everyone on this panel that it's very scary. I think we'll always need not so much a degree of automation, but you know, we have to be realistic, and the most realistic thing is that the planet has to stop eating meat. We are at a point where roughly 70% of the grain that is grown, or the crops that are grown, are going into animals to feed us. And absolutely, it's inhumane, it's disgusting, it's deforestation, it's environmentally catastrophic, and it's health catastrophic. And you just wonder how long it's going to take us to wake up. But wake up we will. And it may be that we have artificial meat. There are lots of companies in California and here in London that are making it. I feel extremely queasy about the idea, but it's better, I suppose, you have to say, although quite want to know what you'd say.
It's a very contentious issue, artificial meat. From the people, my colleagues who are much more closer to the issue than I am, they're saying that it's a very long way away. We're talking 20-plus years from it being affordable, from it being coming down to a realistic price point. So exactly, it's too long. But if it does come along, it will obviously allow a lot of animals not to suffer. So it can only be seen as a good thing when it comes to the suffering of animals and also pollution.
Thank you, Olive. I think James wants to say something.
Can I just add something to that? Because I'm rather missed out on saying about how important research and development is. At the moment, what passes for science in the mouths of the Monsanto apologists is inventing GMs. Anything which you can sell to a farmer and make a profit, that's science, according to the definition of the so-called life science companies. But, in fact, what we need is, as I said before, to work with nature and not against nature. We've got to find out much more understanding of how nature works. It's immensely complicated, the whole ecological business. We've got to try, if we read Edward Wilson, who's probably the leading ecologist, his latest book, Half Earth, which is brilliant, you realise just how ignorant we are, and ignorance, knowledge of your own ignorance is the beginning of wisdom. And so if we can understand that, then research has to be developed in the direction of finding out what our niche in nature is, not to destroy nature, to try and bend it to our will. We have to live with it. And all the successful species are ones that have found a niche in nature and managed to survive. So that nobody's even started to give the kind of enormous investment that goes into the corporate development, nobody has given that money to research into the things we really need to know about how to grow successfully with nature. Sorry.
Thanks very much, James. We're trying to catch up on time, so we have just time for two quick questions, one from here.
Thank you. I like some of the ideas that were coming out. Some of them are quite practical. I think Trina's idea, about the trees, I think that's quite practical. But I kind of think that the agri-villages, I'm just wondering how practical that is. I mean, I speak with a vested interest. I grew up on a dairy farm in Cheshire. I'm a part owner of that dairy farm. I currently work in the food industry. I took issue with because I'm from the dairy farm, I visited over 100 dairy farms. I thought it was a bit of a mischaracterisation, the picture with the cow. I think, they're put on to stop them falling on the floor when they've got lameness and that sort of thing. But I think you kind of need that intensive farming because that's the only way you can really logistically channel the food to a growing population. I think if you went down the agri-village route, I don't think with the urbanisation of the world, it's that practical.
No, that is not true. In fact, it is grossly inefficient form of factory farming and monocultures are grossly inefficient in real terms. They may make sense. They may make sense in financial terms because you can twiddle the, as Ivo will tell you, you can change the financing around so it looks as if it's making sense. All the externalized costs, the costs which are externalized, nobody accounts for. That's very large part of our problems at the moment. But it's absolutely untrue. Read Philip Limbury's excellent books, Farmageddon and Dead Zone, and you'll see that the economics of factory farming and monoculture are nonsense.
And just to add, who's anyone who's really interested in following up your question, on Tuesday, a huge group called the True Cost Accounting is publishing their first report, which has been 5 years in the making, which is going to tell you what is the real cost of a pint of milk, a litre of milk, sorry, in terms of the environment, in terms of health, in terms of animal welfare, in terms of labour that isn't properly paid for, people living in grim conditions, etc., etc. And once you start to say, if you really costed what this stuff is doing to us and to the planet, you would not be paying your 99p, you would be paying something quite different. So they're all tied in, and it's, I hope and think, going to be a really important thing.
So I'd like to thank...
Oh, sorry.
We've got time for just one or two more comments and then your question, John. That's going to be it.
I think one of the issues with the farming and the environment is the number of children, the number of people in urban areas who have no connection with nature, with animals. When I'm not being chair of a parks group in real life, I was a former head of a children's centre, and I'm director of a charity now working with vulnerable families. And the number of children who've never seen in real life a cow, a pig, a goat. So if you're expecting this generation of the future to care about agri-farming when they've never had an opportunity to engage with green spaces in their local area, I think there's a twin approach here. There's the academic side, the research, the statistics, and whether it's bunkum or not. But there's also allowing people opportunities to have a visceral connection with the air that they breathe, the land that they live in.
Just one quick comment on the picture from the dairy farm. So, what everybody saw there is what I saw, and that site wouldn't exist if the cows were outside. You wouldn't worry about them falling on a concrete slatted floor in their own excrement because they'd be outside. They'd be on ground. They'd be on earth. So this is exactly what factory farming is. It's using animals as machines at any cost, even if it is putting them in shackles so they can barely walk around in their own excrement.
So lots of time. There are lots of questions. Sorry, John, we're going to try and catch up now.
Okay.
I think we're trying to catch up on time, so if it's okay with you, John, we'll catch up in the follow-up session, which will be running down the corridor, straight across the corridor. So I'd like to finish by thanking Sophie, and Rosie and Olaf and Tria and James. A great round of applause, please, from the whole audience. This debate will now continue across the corridor. A very short micro break before the next session on ideas into action.